Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm the producer, Caleb Keith, and I'm joined by our hosts, Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. Follow these great minds as they answer pressing questions about theology, history, and apologetics. This show is brought to you by 1517 The Legacy Project, serving to proclaim the gospel to all people, especially those broken by the church.
Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and I'm here today with only one of our regular hosts, Dr. Keith, and the Thinking Fellows and 1517 The Legacy Project are in Germany today. We're doing kind of an extravagant trip here to a wonderful conference that one of our other guests today, Dr. Uwe Simonetto, will talk about a little bit in a minute. But just a quick introduction to that, Dr. Keith and I got on a whirlwind flight Wednesday morning, Pacific time.
Two planes and a rental car on the Autobahn just to be here yep. to record.
And so now we're here this morning, and we're going to do something a little strange. We don't usually record and post the show in the same day, but we're going to be able to do that today because it's Friday in Germany already. And so we're going to record what is this morning in Germany. I'm going to post it tonight here in Germany. That means everybody in America will get it at their usual time Friday morning. So it's very exciting. I have a little opportunity to do that. We wanted to thank. We have gotten help to come to Germany. An extravagant donation has allowed us to come here. And those are the kinds of things that you listeners love to see and hear are these trips and these wonderful guests that we have on the show. So thank you for your donations. Thank you for supporting the show. Keep it up, and we get to keep doing things like this. And so now I'll introduce our guests so you guys can figure out what this show is really going to be about. So today we have a very special guest, Dr. Robert Kolb, who was a professor at St. Louis Seminary for a very long time. Now retired, but you're still
very
teaching.
Very long time.
Yeah, very long time.
Everything's a very long time when you're 21.
Yeah, that's true. When it exceeds my lifespan, it's a very, very long time. And so he is with us today. And then, as I mentioned earlier, Dr. Uwe Simonetto. And so, Dr. Keith, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, first of all, I want to say welcome to our guests. Thank you for being on the show. Thank you for being so gracious to take your time. Uwe's my friend, and I see him all the time when he's in the States. So, hello, Uwe. How are you?
Hello, Keith.
And it's an honor for me to be recording with Dr. Bob Kolb. He's absolutely one of my heroes. So I'm a little starstruck here. If I trip over my own tongue, that's why. Thank you so much for being on the show with us.
It's a delight to be here.
And I thought maybe we'd do this. How about I'll kind of just give you guys an opportunity to introduce yourselves. And Uwe, maybe you could tell us a little bit about this conference and the International Lay Society. And then hopefully I can get you guys to mix it up a little bit on Two Kingdoms. And we'll go from there since that's your
I'm
thing.
I'm the left-hand kingdom guy, of course. Bob Kolb is the right-hand kingdom guy, at least for the purpose of this day, you see, we're here.
Right.
We are here in Neuen Dettelsau, which is... a small town, once a tiny village, in Franconia, in northern Bavaria, which was the town of Wilhelm Löhe, one of the giants of Lutheran theology in the 19th century. And he has started what is called has an awfully long name, and I won't trouble you with the German name because it makes it even longer, but it's the Society for Society for External and Domestic Mission in the sense of the Lutheran Church, the Löhe Society. And this society is holding its 20th anniversary conference, the 20th anniversary of a magazine which I helped found called CA, like Confessio Augustana. It's a quarterly, very beautiful magazine, small circulation, but nonetheless, it's widely read in Lutheran circles. And we've brought this conference together of confessional Lutherans and other Christians trying to network faithful Christians and also instill those who need some theological structure, evangelicals, for example, with a theological spine, as it were. And it seems to be working. It was a similar conference elsewhere in Germany last week. The Lutherans are a small group here in this country of Luther, confessional Lutherans. But they're active and they're thinkers and they're good pastors here, and you'll find this afternoon a lot of very interesting people, including the Lutheran Archbishop of Riga, Vanax is his name, who will be preaching here tomorrow. So that's what we're doing. And Bob Kolb and I will speak about the liberation theology, as Bob calls it, Lutheranism, Lutheran theology being the actual liberation theology. And I'll say, well, what has Christ's work on the cross and with the resurrection liberated us for, us here, residents of this imperfect and fading world? And so I think that's going to be a good tension. We'll have a good tension, which we might even reflect in this podcast today.
And Dr. Kolb?
I'm Bob Kolb, and I'm a retired professor from Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, though they still let me teach a little bit. And when I came to the seminary nearly a quarter century ago, the intention was that we share the blessings of our way of thinking with people, particularly in post-Soviet Europe. And so my assignment was to spend about 3 months each year teaching in Estonia, Latvia, Russia, was once in Georgia, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Poland. And then invitations brought me to India, to Japan, to Korea, to a number of other places. And that was a great blessing because it certainly expanded my way of thinking and my way of looking at Luther texts and the whole Lutheran tradition. My specialty really was post-Luther Lutheranism, the next generations. When I was a graduate student, there was so much bibliography on Luther, it was intimidating. So I worked on his students and Luther's impact, Melanchthon's impact as well on their students. But 2017 has drawn me back into Luther studies. And unfortunately, there's a dearth of Luther scholars in the world today. In the United States, we have some very bright younger people who are working on Luther, but they are mostly at small colleges where they don't have a chance to research and write very much. And so my work has moved from the second and third generations of the Reformation traditions, really, into Luther and Melanchthon in the first part of the century.
May I add something to this here? I'm also introducing a revision of my book, which is called The Fabricated Luther in Germany, but the German version will be titled, or is titled, Luther, the Teacher of Resistance. And that is to refute this image of Luther being the teacher of quietists, of quietism, and therefore Hitler's spiritual ancestor. And a very, very interesting aspect of Lutheran theology is actually his resistance theology, and which pertains specifically to our world today. Luther said that, of course, one has to obey authority because it's from God. They are the Leitorgeigartheu, the servants of God. But if authority turns tyrannical, then lesser magistrates, namely, for example, family fathers or, in our case, the voters and others, must resist and must ultimately even topple tyrants, but only, and now think of what happened in Libya and in Iraq, but only if you have a replacement, so you don't create a chaos, a void. I sometimes wish that in Washington some people had read Luther on this topic before they marched into Iraq and or into Libya, without actually thinking next of what are we going to put in place so that these people, that we don't create chaos, and as it turned out, a very evil substitute for power, namely ISIS, the Islamist caliphate. I hope we can press on this rather well. The book has been well received so far, and I'm trying to tell Germans, German newspapers and television people, that they should look at what Luther really did say, not what Luther's detractors said in the World War II, what Luther actually did say about how to obey authority and how to deal with authority and ultimately how to topple authority in a democracy. This is particularly important because we are, as voters, sovereigns in a democracy.
Well, you've led us into where we need to go. So what I thought would be fun today would be to revisit an episode that we already did on Two Kingdoms. We did that a while ago when we were covering the topics of the Loci or just topics of theology. And it was actually one of the episodes when we were recording it. It was Adam and Rod and myself, and we kept saying it'd be nice to have somebody here that actually knew about Two Kingdoms theology. Because the three of us, you know, beyond just our normal training, none of us had specialized in it at all. And so I thought it'd be fun today if we can just kind of go through, you're sort of working at the edges of it a little bit, Uwe, when you're talking about what we can do and responsibilities in what we would say is the left-hand kingdom. But maybe if we could, just for our listeners, recap, what is this idea of two kingdoms theology or two kingdoms theory? Dr. Kolb and I were speaking at breakfast, and he said to me that Luther uses it in three ways, and I thought that was kind of interesting. Can you expand on that for us?
Yeah, occasionally the phrase occurs fairly often in Luther's writings, and occasionally, but very seldom, it refers to something like church and state as institutions. That was part of the medieval interpretation of Augustine's Two Cities, that it referred to the, not really to state as we understand it as an institution, but to the prince as the one entrusted, as Uwe was saying, God with keeping public order.
Romans 13.
Yeah, yeah. But that's relatively seldom. Luther has two other uses that are fairly frequent, both of them. The one refers to God's kingdom and Satan's kingdom. And they are always at war. And where are they at war? They are at war in his other usage of two kingdoms that I like to talk about as realms. The vertical realm, our relationship with God, and the horizontal realm, our relationship with all of his creation. And sometimes I used to confuse two realms with two kinds of righteousness, which is his basic anthropology. What are we as human beings? We are children of God and brothers and sisters to other people in this world. And those two are distinct ideas because the realms really refer to two places where we are both passively righteous and actively righteous. And so I think I appreciate Uwe's very clear interpretation of how the, as he would say, two kingdoms, the vertical and horizontal realms, relate to each other in the Lutheran tradition, and how that's a much better solution, I think, than many other Christian attempts to relate, as H. Richard Niebuhr said 65 years ago, Christ and culture.
Yes.
What he called Christ and culture and paradox. I don't think it's a paradox to say children relate to their parents in a different way than they relate to their siblings. So I like to talk about it in Christ and culture in two dimensions. But this Lutheran view that you can be both very appreciative of God's creation and culture as God's creation, and at the same time critical of its doing bad things, it's evil.
Right, yeah.
This combination of appreciation and critical stance is, I think, really important, especially as Christians often in our world feel the world is hostile and we've got to retreat into our own little corner. This appreciation that Luther had for the goodness of culture as a gift of God, as well as the necessity to be critical, it's very important.
And our contribution to this culture. The reason why I like the word kingdom, actually, of course, being German, I use the German word Reich, which is not necessarily a kingdom. It's a realm, as you say. But the interesting imagery, I mean, I'm a journalist. I'm trying to sort of condense certain topics into theological topics into journalistic jargon. That we are, the Christian is a citizen of two realms, of two kingdoms, both of which, we have to stress, both of which are God's realms.
That's right,
Now, the Christian has in common with other people that he is a citizen of what we call the left-hand realm or left-hand kingdom, where God is hidden. And where God rules through what Luther used this marvelous image of the Lava Dei, the mask of God. We are master of God, the master which God acts in this world. And what our obligations are here. Now, Bob will explain this afternoon in this conference here how we are liberated to be, as Christians, citizens in the world. We are liberated because as citizens of the right-hand realm, God no longer sees our sin. Out of grace and our faith in Christ's work on the cross and resurrection. So, but not to crawl into a catacomb. Now we are living in catacombs. All Christians here in this increasingly secularized world live in catacombs, but not to hide behind old people's bones, but to actually radiate out of this and roll up our sleeves and work in this world. And one concept I find particularly interesting is that we are God's co-creators in this world. We are participants in the ongoing work of creation. We do this by planting plants, by raising cattle, or ultimately colonizing the universe. That is co-creator. We sin automatically in the left-hand kingdom because in the left-hand kingdom is under sin, and so are we. As Christians, we can then always turn over to the right-hand kingdom where we're citizens and ask for forgiveness and be given forgiveness. But it does mean that we should not, as citizens in the left-hand kingdom, responsible citizens of the left-hand kingdom, stop operating and stop working responsibly, worrying that we might sin in our vocations, in what we are doing, I as a journalist or I as a voter. Because we are assured of salvation and of righteousness, being citizens of the right-hand kingdom. I believe that this is so pertinent to our reality, especially here in Europe and in the United States. Spent half my year in America, the other half in Europe. I believe that this is a very pertinent theology for contemporary society, more so than ever before, perhaps, because we can actually persuade people, Christians, to act in this world, get rest. Don't worry when they get drunk once in a while because have a glass of wine, so did Luther. But actually do our jobs.
That really is refreshing news.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Jesus didn't drink Coca-Cola either. I mean, I just wanted to remind you of that. And he also knew a good wine from a bad one. He created the good one. So that is, I think, so important. And when you see a society, a postmodern society like the European one and like the North American one, and you seek something to cling on to, what am I expected to do here in this world? What is my job here? What does God want me to do? Should I just go into a monastery, keep quiet and pray the hours or what, and sometimes work in the garden? Or should I participate in forming this world, knowing as a Christian that I'm saved? That, I think, is significant. And that is something that we can convince, can radiate into other Christian groups with, evangelical groups, some of the more law-oriented groups. We can say, come on, we are saved as Christians. Now let's just do our jobs here.
Well, that's a good place for us to take our break. And as we come back, we'll let Dr. Kolb come in and react to that a little bit. But as we go to our break, I would love our listeners to just meditate on the fact that Uva is willing to suffer for Jesus in beautiful Southern California near the beach half the year and the other half the year in the south of France. Right?
Southwest of France, okay, but it's also beautiful.
Yeah. All right, we'll be back.
Welcome to our break. As you've been listening, we have two amazing guests with us. And Dr. Simonetto happens to have one of his books on sale in the 1517 shop. And so today at our break, I think we'll have the unique opportunity to hear you talk about Triumph of the Absurd. What is that book about?
Well, it's about actually my time as a war correspondent in Vietnam over a period of 5 years. So this is a memoir, but of course the title speaks to the absurdity of losing that war, which was militarily won, at least the way I experienced it and many of us correspondents experienced it, militarily won by the time of the Tet Offensive in 1968, which I covered in the front lines in Hue, and where the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese military infrastructure and political infrastructure in South Vietnam were wiped out. And because of the false impressions given by certain correspondents who weren't actually correspondents, but commentators such as Walter Cronkite, who interpreted the events in the Tet Offensive in 1968 as a loss or as evidence that that this war could not be won militarily, and therefore America should negotiate its way out of it. And of course, the result was, yes, America did negotiate her way out of it. This is after her military, after the American military and the South Vietnamese military actually had won the war militarily. And as a result, of course, in 1975, the North Vietnamese took over. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed, executed. Hundreds of thousands more were tortured in concentration camps. I know many of these people. They're friends of mine in California now. And of course, millions and millions fled Vietnam in all directions. You have South Vietnamese refugees here in Germany being exceedingly successful, I hasten to add, as they are in the United States. That is what I'm describing, my own experiences, sometimes humorous too. It wasn't all war and bang, bang, bang. I mean, there were some entertaining parts as well. And I also relate this to recent wars where, again, America unfortunately didn't show the patience, and predictably so, because the North Vietnamese defense minister always said, he said this back in the 1950s already, that the Americans won't have the patience to see out a protracted war. They would call for the troops to be cut, to the boys to come home for Christmas, and they would ultimately make any dirty compromise to get out of it, and then, of course, cede the territory to the enemy, which we've experienced in Vietnam, even more tragically in Cambodia, where one third of the population were annihilated by the Khmer Rouge. Laos, similar thing. And now we experience it again in Iraq, where I think irresponsibly and in a very ill-considered way, troops were withdrawn, and the next thing you had territory for the Islamic Caliphate, and that is the war we're fighting now, all of us in the Middle East, and that also brought us 1.1 million Syrian refugees into Germany here, where we sit right now. I think Germany is handling it better than expected, although lots of criticism about that, but they are here, 1.1 million. Came over the last 12 months. So that is essentially what The Triumph of the Absurd, with a subtitle, A Reporter's Love for the Abandoned People of Vietnam. Because I wrote this out of great love for the South Vietnamese people, whose suffering I shared, and who are now, those who fled to America, are being huge contributors to American culture, American economy, and well-being, especially in California, where we live.
Thank you. And that can be found at shop.1517legacy.com. I got it this time.
You did get it this time. So, yeah, you can find it on our store. It's available on Amazon. And I have to say, it's available as an amazing audiobook. The stories in there come across in the audiobook format amazingly.
And let me just add one thing. This is my hubris comes into play here. It is out in four languages. First in English, then I wrote it again in German, then I edited it again in French, and it has also been translated into Vietnamese. So if you don't read any of the previous three languages, then pick up the Vietnamese edition.
All right, thank you.
All right, yep.
All right, back to our topic. We cut Dr. Kolb off in, as we went to the break, and I just to recap, we were talking about two kingdoms, theology, and got some wonderful insights from both Dr. Kolb and Dr. Simonuto. And, you know, I was struck, Uwe, as you were talking, by the idea that really what I think is unique about this is, in a particularly Lutheran way too, is the idea that when we discuss two kingdoms, what we're really talking about is the fact that Christians being, like you said, already free before God, you know, saved by grace alone, through faith alone, on account of Christ alone, their works in the world aren't what benefit them before God.
That's right.
At all, right? That was taken care of by Christ. Within this idea of the left-hand kingdom is where we kind of get to work out our works before God, but in a particular way as we serve our neighbor. And the famous phrase that comes to mind for me all the time is that God doesn't need your works, but your neighbor does. And as you're encouraging us to get involved, to, you know, contribute to the culture, contributing to your neighbor, right? When you contribute to the culture, you're contributing to your neighbor. When you fulfill your vocation, you're contributing to your neighbor. I just got done this past Monday at the university. I helped redesign over the course of the last 5 years their freshman seminar course, which is a course that every freshman that comes into the university has to take. And if you've ever been a freshman at a university and taken that course, you know that they're notoriously viewed as a waste of time, where you sort of get your hand held as you walk to the library and then to the wellness center and then to academic advising. And when I first came to the university, I started teaching a couple sections of that class every semester and was frustrated by it. And in the redevelopment of it, what we've done is we've added Gene Veith's book, God at Work, as this sort of the central touch point for the entire course over the 16 weeks of the semester. And then we do Monday lectures on the various sort of chapter ideas within God at Work. You know, what is vocation? What is your vocation in the workplace? What is your vocation to family? And I do one of the introductory lectures on what is the vocation of student. Yeah. And we use a little piece that I wrote with Scott Ashman on the vocation of student. And what I try to stress to them time and time again is that, now this is important stuff, that you are free before God on account of Christ. And this is important stuff, how you are living out your calling.
Let me make just one very precise statement here, which is very, very, it comes from Weber actually, but using Luther. Max Weber, the sociologist of religion. He was an agnostic, but he loved Lutheran theology because Luther taught that we are called in vocatione, in our vocation, whatever we are doing. Now, as a freshman student, for example, or as a husband or wife, in vocatione, not per vocationem, not through our work,
right,
in what we already are.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We serve our neighbor out of love, and in so doing, render the highest possible service to God in this world, which makes us members of the universal priesthood of all believers. And the distinction between in vocatione, which doesn't require anything special, it means just that we have to orient our heads in the direction of the other instead of looking at our own belly buttons. And not
it's in the doings of everyday life.
In our everyday life, everyday vocation. We have oodles of vocations every day. And not through our vocations, which would bring it dangerously close to works righteousness. Right. And that, of course, would be totally un-Lutheran. To me, it's totally forgotten this. You see, this is something that...
That's a wonderful distinction to me.
It is the distinction. And you, if you go into... I don't have it offhand now, but it's in Luther's Genesis lectures. He describes distinctly the various vocations in which the handmaiden is rendering a service out of love to her neighbor just as much as the master or the prince or whatever.
Or the mother when she's nursing her child.
Correct, yeah.
That type of thing.
So I didn't want to jump in, but...
I have a couple, points that I found in Uwe's fascinating tour of Two Kingdoms. But first of all, I wanted to mention that I had a couple hours in Frankfurt between trains. Yeah. And I wanted to make sure that I'd be safe on the train. And so I thought, I better make sure that God really likes me. And so I went across, went out in front of the train station. And in those 2 hours, I helped 103 older people across the street. And I thought, that would please God. You know, only 92 of them wanted to go across the street. But I got 103 across. Well, the point, of course, is that if my works are what makes my connection to God, which presumably is the most important thing, no matter what I call God, that gives me security for my whole life and a sense of identity as belonging to the right party, at least. If my works do it, then I instrumentalize the neighbor as a tool for building my own ego.
That's wonderful.
If I am freed simply because God's made me his child, and I put as much into that as I put into being the child of Ralph and Eva Kolb, then I'm truly free to serve the neighbor. But I wanted to make a couple of points to help clarify why it's so so important to make the distinction between Luther's usage of God and Satan with kingdom and horizontal and vertical with kingdom. Satan also invades my vertical relationship. Every day I fail to fear, love, and trust in God above all things. My trust is under continual attack. It's not just that I do bad things to my neighbor. It's that I forget God, I insult him. I'm in that constant struggle, also in the vertical realm. And in the horizontal realm, I think it's important to remember that as filled with sin as the world is, the world belongs to our family. It's the property of our Father. We have a right and obligation to keep up the family's property, estate. And that means that, as Uwe has said so well, our participation in the culture is not an option. It's a part of our calling, and it's very important for the culture to have our input. The fact that we do not have to reach a certain goal in terms of horizontal results for our performance. Our performance has to be godly. The results we leave to the Lordship of Christ. And that means that with Luther's understanding of the two realms, we are freed to make compromises. As my colleague James Veltz likes to say, the best is the enemy of the good. We can reach 80% or even 40% is better than 0%. We can work within the culture to make improvements. And Luther's often got the reputation of being such a pessimist about this world. Not at all. He was very optimistic about at least short-term results. He did think that there are going to be ups and downs in terms of evil's triumphing and good's response. But he believed that cultural improvement was possible, and he was very angry when the Wittenberger didn't want to come back to Wittenberg in 1543 or 44 because they weren't behaving properly. He expected that Christians would make a difference in society.
That's interesting. I really like that you said that. I mean, you guys have both helped me even reframe my own thoughts on this or clarify it. I have written for the past 4 years for a website called The Jagged Word. And the role I usually take on that is as sort of not cultural interpreter, but oftentimes critiquing culture, oftentimes just sort of look at what's going on around us. And the biggest criticism I get anytime I think I've nailed a spot-on critique is that, boy, Scott, what do you think? Things have always been good, and now they're all of a sudden bad. Mm-hmm. You know, don't you know things have always been bad? And my response to that is usually something like, well, I think that they've always been bad and that they've been good too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that our time is both unlike all other times in history and just like all other times mm-hmm. in history, where there have been people who are called in their vocation to really contribute and to critique and to try to point out where the culture is going south and try to contribute to the good aspects of it. I mean, especially Uwe, you have to hear this kind of same criticism all the time when you sort of critique political movements and whatnot. Sure. How do you respond to that?
When you hear this criticism, first of all, I would say to the person, you make it better, but consider who you're doing it for, mm-hmm. not yourself, but the other. Bob and I were at breakfast discussing the state of the German railways, which, by the way,
which was fascinating.
is still a million times better than Amtrak. I mean, it is actually a functioning system, and the trains are fast and comfortable. But the air conditioning tends to conk out in this, and. And here's the thing, Bob made a very relevant statement. He said, whenever there is a mess up there, and you know, you have to understand, I think this Frankfurt Station has about six thousand arrivals and departures. I think per day or something. It's incredible, you know, how many trains run out in and out and in and out. And you know, there are mess ups. You don't have trolleys anymore to cart your luggage because you have those morons stealing them or dumping them somewhere or destroying them and all sorts of things. You don't have porters anymore, so old geezers like I have to schlep their own stuff and break their backs. But then Bob said something. The one thing is, in all this mess, the individual employees of the German railways are wonderful. They're charming.
Right.
They're helpful. I mean, you can sit down, at least in first class, and there's most interesting when you go to France, for example, on the train. The German ticket collector comes around and says, may I bring you a drink? And may I bring you a sausage? And the French communist colleague, who also travels on the same, sits there just grinning at this idiot German colleague. And the German colleague actually does exactly what we said in about vocation. It's his vocation to serve his neighbor lovingly, and they do so. The idiots are in the management, who look at figures
and have very little contact with their neighbor on the train.
Well, not particularly interested, I think, and they just want to. They look at the figures. They look at the. And I think they make erroneous decisions as a result of that. But what gives me courage going to Germany, especially this new generation Germany, the 1968ers are fading into the background and their self-righteous and snooty offspring are also sort of waning. And now you actually have young, fresh people who are not, by the most part, practicing Christians. They might even not be knowingly Christians, but they act the way, now I would use Max Weber again, as if they had internalized the Lutheran doctrine of vocation. And I believe this is true. I mean, you know, if I may, I don't want to hog all the time here, but the one interesting thing, fascinating thing is this. In the 1980s, Time magazine interviewed Roland Peugeot, the French car manufacturer, about the mystery, the secret of the quality of his cars. Peugeot cars used to be the best built in France. And Peugeot said, well, it is because I'm from a Lutheran family. He comes from Montbéliard, which used to be the Württemberg county of Mempelgard. And we were brought up to serve our neighbors in our vocations. I remember that interview was wonderful, okay? You have Lutheran structures, Lutheran car manufacturers, or at least Mercedes, Audi, Porsche, and Volkswagen. And the Volkswagens are still built wonderfully, but the management committed such a massive un-Christian, un-Lutheran screw-up to cheat, try to cheat the American government and its emissions control and all that sort of thing, that they're actually putting this survival of Volkswagen at risk. It might cost them $100 billion in penalties, $100 billion. I'm driving a Volkswagen in the States and I'm driving Audi in France. In America, I go to my Volkswagen dealer occasionally to have my car checked. Do you know, they sit there, the salespeople or mechanics, hardly anybody comes by anymore because of the bad reputation that these idiots in Wolfsburg, not the workers, not the engineers, those idiots in management who think they could be, I mean, it really is the proof of the correctness of the Germans saying that arrogance is the art, I have to get that right. Arrogance is the art to be proud of one's own stupidity. I mean, to do that sort of thing, you know? Germans in Southern California going now to the Volkswagen agents to bring them gifts and say how sorry and embarrassed they are about the behavior. That again fills me with pride. Local Californian Germans, there are lots of them. In this country here of Luther, you see still the survival, as Bob Corp mentioned this morning over breakfast, over internalized vocation, consciousness of vocation service to the neighbor by the personnel, and of course the departure of this by the leadership. And that goes clear through society, including the church.
Thank you, Uwe. Dr. Kolb, before we close, you have anything else that you'd like to share?
No, I just think that this is this whole, I was going to say realm, but I shouldn't in this context, this whole topic that we've been discussing is really an important one because in the United States, Nordic Lutherans have been fairly active in making contributions to the political realm, at least, but German Lutherans have tended to be a little shyer. We were pushed into our own ghetto where we had been comfortably living, but the doors were kind of closed in the events of 1917 and 1918 when Germany and the United States were at war. And so we've been a little hesitant to venture into the public arena with our testimony. And I think it's terribly important for us to understand, as Uwe has been stressing, that, as I just said, it's our Father's land, and we have an obligation to participate in the adventure, the wonderful adventure,
right,
of U.S. democracy that is always threatened because it's a good gift of God by Satan's perversions. And yet remains, in essence, a good gift of God. And it will remain so also through our participation, through our being faithful in the callings in which God has placed us.
I think that may be a good place to end up, and I'll just rephrase it another way. We have the wonderful invitation to participate in the great adventure of civil life.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for being on the Thinking Fellows. Again, it's an honor to have both of you. I'll see Uwe again soon, I'm sure. I had to come all the way to Germany to meet Dr. Kolb, but that's okay. And we'll be on again next time.
All right. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.